Right. I'm actually going to go back to number six a little bit, because we last week we kind of discussed broadly, vaguely, about what the subject ought to be, what kind of issues arise in the subject, and didn't come to any conclusions. So I was actually reading Robert C. Neville's books. There's something called the Boston Comparative Religious Ideas Project that happened some years ago, where they thought we'll get lots of professors, get them to sit down and compare ideas really, really hard a lot, and see if a systematic sort of structure of study comes out of this that we can then use for everybody. And they did this. And while it's kind of interesting, I also think it still looks like just as confused, messy, unsystematic and unstructured a project actually usually happens with respect to their attempt to try. But for instance, when I looked at the section where they talk about the insider-outsider problem, which we're going to talk about today, the idea of how you can understand people's beliefs from the inside, they kind of say, yes, well, we addressed this issue when we had many structured meetings about it. And at the end, we came up with a series of points that we tried to address, although, of course, in the end, we didn't really have any concrete solution. But we thought hard about the fact that we had no concrete solution and reflected deeply upon it and would like to note it in a systematic and structured way. You know, and you kind of think, oh, God. And, you know, of course, it's easy for me to think, oh, well, there you go. But I think it's probably true that most of us end up doing that. You know, we're still waiting for someone to say, here's a concrete solution, a block on which we can now start to stand. So, you know, understanding that is a difficulty. I'm just briefly going to go through the notes that we didn't really go through last week for that, just to put some points forward, and because they do, I think, relate to the phenomenology of religion as well. In a sense, the guiding and connecting theme for both of them is how can you not impose yourself on other people when you study their beliefs? How is it possible? Is it ever possible not to just be using them to fulfill certain categories, issues and ideas that you yourself have and are projecting outwards? So last week it was on prejudice, protest and the study of religions, creating a new academic field. We looked at the idea that we have all these different disciplines, not only religious studies, the study of religions, theology, divinity, comparative religion and world religions, but also, of course, psychology, anthropology, sociology, oriental studies, linguistics, and a range of other disciplines. How can we put them into one subject? You know, this is what I find inspiring. One of the things I find inspiring about studying religion is that they're all there. But of course, you know, if we're going to be responsible and be taken seriously by other disciplines, we have to know how, we have to be able to articulate how we are effectively integrating those different methodologies and approaches. Part of the difficulty is that they're not just different methodologies, which one could use as different tools to study something. Some of them are actually genuinely different ideas of what the thing you're studying is and may therefore be incommensurable. So that's one of the questions, is what should the discipline be? And of course, the other side of the question is, how can we stop the discipline from being bad, not methodologically bad, but ethically and politically bad, i.e. misrepresenting its subject? I think that's gone through many stages, that concern over kind of prejudice and ethical responsibility. At one point, people were worried about overly textual approaches, you know, insofar as the study came out of basically linguistics, oriental studies, people getting hold of Indian texts. You know, we all know that, for instance, the study of India at one time was just the study of the Upanishads. How then could they try and improve upon that situation and fill out the picture? People did then try and deal with this in many ways. Archaeology, anthropology and other subjects came into it. Of course, anthropology then raises new concerns. Anthropology often had a strongly colonial overturn, a colonialist overturn. It was done by people who were embedded in colonial structures of study, and it often reflected their attitudes. You know, and as we know, the Indian Institute here at one time was seen as a resource for people within the British Empire to try and understand the countries that they were essentially, quote-unquote, governing, and also, of course, quote-unquote, using. So this post-colonial studies has become very important, and of course Edward Said's book, Orientalism, is really the kind of key text for that, for raising that as an issue. And as an issue that was a deep hermeneutic issue, what are the sub-structures, what are the foundations of our belief about studying that are problematic? What are the meta-structures, what are the assumptions that are hidden and the larger conclusions that we reach that all kind of treat the subject as if it's a tool, a resource for our needs? In a way, though, I think that post-colonial phase is also, in its turn, kind of moving forward. It's almost as if every 6 to 10 years there's a new problem that you try and counteract. So in a way, people are moving a little bit away from the post-colonial thing. People have... there's a... Brilliant. Yeah, there's one there. It's wonderful. For instance, I think people have been concerned that the very words world religions have been problematic. What's a world religion? When does something get to be a world religion? What about the ones that aren't quote-unquote world religions? You know, the whole question, why is Judaism considered a world religion? It doesn't have any universal, it does have some, but you know, not in the same way, universal claims to applying to all people in the world, nor indeed does it represent all that large a number of people. Nor in any particular single culture. Why is that a world religion and not, say, Shinto, for instance? Certainly, probably as many, I don't know if that's true, but one can imagine that there would be as many Shinto or Confucian influenced immigrants in the Western world, quote unquote, in the rest of the world, as there are perhaps Jewish culture. I don't know what it was. Shinto would mean, I guess that's... Okay, I guess
and
that's just the Japanese...
Shinto straight down the line, aren't they?
No, that's right. But Shinto and Confucianism and Buddhism will often, almost always, be at least a little bit mixed together. But in a way, that reflects exactly the same prejudice. Are we only going to accept those religions where it's just that? You know, a lot of the world, you look at Africa, you look at Asia, a lot of the world has always mixed together different religions. Why would we want to ignore that? How interesting, how potentially useful a model, how fascinating in itself, how illuminating. You know, but for instance then, those religions are often seen as in some sense not proper religions with proper kind of universal structures.
I'm sure you can go to the world religion for all bits of other people's religions stolen.
Yeah, well, I think that's true, and that's kind of, so that's kind of, you know, the point is that people are starting to say we need to be more inclusive, to reflect a wider range of religions, and we also need to be more, we need to what we call complexify each particular religion. You know, we shouldn't really be talking about Christianity, we should be talking about Protestantism, Catholicism, Eastern Orthodoxy, which gets very little look in when people talk about Christianity. And then, of course, even those are completely diverse. And, of course, a point that I feel quite strongly is that Christianity never had a big, strong, hard boundary, like a, you know, Great Wall of China, between it and the other religions. Christian theology has grown up so much in interaction with Jewish theology, the Jews within the Christian world, with Muslim theology. Thomas Aquinas is reading all kinds of texts by Muslims. And indeed, you know, there's been an ongoing encounter through trade and culture with places like India. So, of course, you know, they aren't really one big single strand, each within a bounded territory. And, the, you know, there's a sort of suggestion in the inside or outside of debate, which I feel starts to be a little bit outdated, that we never, you know, I've said this before, that we never step over the wall. That when, if you do step over the wall out of your own culture into another culture, you won't be able to see anything properly because you'll have the glasses of your old culture on and you'll never be able to take them off. I find it very parochial and problematic model of how humans work. All through history, humans have lived in multiple cultures. Traders, merchants, travellers have been crucial movers and shakers in every culture, never acknowledged in any kind of textual, historical, political context, but actually the traders, you know, the Silk Route, for instance, going from Europe through to Asia and back again, made a huge difference on how the cultures developed. And of course, you know, immigrants, extremely important. Different religions merging together and creating new religions, partly what Christianity is. You know, it's a cobbling together, but it's a fusion of many different influences. And so these kinds of issues, I think, haven't really been brought properly in to bear on these kinds of debates, but people are working on them.
Yeah, well, if you're an anthropologist coming from Britain or America, and you're going off into the rainforest studying the pygmies or whatever, then you are walking into a different worldview.
Yeah.
And that's when the insider-outsider issue does become relevant, because there hasn't been a lot of interchange between those two cultures.
Yeah. I agree, and it's absolutely essential, and in fact it's become more and more a part of people's everyday experience, because people more and more actually go on holiday to other places, enter into work agreements with other places, you know, move to other places, and people in the other places are often more and more moving into quote unquote our territories. So I think it's part of a broad issue that actually we have to deal with, but I think it shouldn't be dealt with just as some funny little technical issue that arises when religion scholars put on their travelling caps and go into another place. If you see what I mean, that's incredibly important, but the idea that it's insolvable, which sometimes is kind of encountered.
I think part of the issue is that academics need their categories in order to compare one thing to another, and so it's an imposed structure, as you say.
So it should be studied, but I just think that it's, for some people, it's gone to a place where people have said, well, this means that, you know, we'll never really understand. And there's a point at which that's a misunderstanding of what understanding is. Sorry, go ahead.
Was there a criticism of you know, that bloke who did that tribe program, would go and sit in the jungle and take various hallucinogenics and become one of the tribe? Remember, you know, all the criticisms that you get in the Radio Times going, he's just being a colonialist. Look at him with his chalky white face and taking drugs and going, oh, aren't they funny? That's kind of illustrative of the problem, because he's clearly trying to be a phenomenologist when you think about it and go in, be it, live it. But then everyone still goes, ah, you're not really an Eskimo.
I think that's true, but I know what you mean.
He's not really an Eskimo, that's why.
Yeah, that's the thing, but they always say that he is.
People have conversion experience. That shows how fluid the concept of who you are is.
Yeah.
Bruce Parry really be an Eskimo?
But I think...
Could he really be an Eskimo?
Yeah, he could be.
Well, okay, partly what one wants to end up saying is, what is it going to mean to be the Eskimo?
Yeah, is it the others recognizing you or yourself?
I mean, I agree that there's a sense in which he's never going to have the perspective of someone who's grown up within that culture. The extent to which that means he can't understand them, or he won't get the whole, you know, the whole picture, or his observations will ultimately not be quite valid, or, you know, he ought to be a bit more part of them, I think hasn't been well thought through. There may be people from neighbouring cultures who become, you know, those issues exist within those communities. What it means to understand. Sometimes the person from outside will have new understandings that will then contribute to the self-understanding of the community. I think that people's identities are actually more fluid, and we see that more and more the more that people themselves travel. I think people do, we talk about conversion experiences, people do have the experience that they feel more at home in the new culture than they do in their old culture. But, you know, and that's not to say that they've become an Eskimo. You know, there's a halfway place. Not a halfway place. I think there's a sliding scale and a more complex situation. But the idea that you either are or you are not the Eskimo is kind of misguided, I think, to some extent. Yeah, well, I mean, he's not. What did we expect from this guy? He was going to go in there, and suddenly we wouldn't be able to tell him from the rest. Except, you know, it's kind of a romantic idea in itself. Except for the slight, you know, the slightly pearly sheen of his skin as he disappears into the jungle. You know, that's never really how it was going to be. And of course, it's not really what he's aiming for. That would be kind of silly. But perhaps there are deep kinds of understanding. I mean, one thing that's not acknowledged is over the millennia, people have emigrated into new cultures, married into new cultures, had children within to new cultures, so that they feel that the new culture, in a sense, is much more their home than their old culture was. I think it's not right to say that where your birth and early upbringing is, necessarily is what will always ultimately define you. And people who haven't had, you know, I mean, I speak from my own perspective, but if you've had to move at an early stage into a new culture, you realise that you don't necessarily identify yourself more with one than another, and you start to see from the inside how permeable cultural boundaries, I think, can be. None of that is to say that you're ever going to be, if I decide to move to Indonesia, I'm ever going to be Indonesian.
Do you think it's strange then that passports are issued largely on where you're born, unless you're like a New Zealander who wants to play rugby for Japan, for
example? No, because passports are part of the social contract. Passports are a matter of practical, you know, practicality, and that's acknowledged in the fact that actually you can change your nationality, that if you marry someone else, that's seen as so profound an entry of the other culture into your everyday life and identity that you then, of course, become immediately accessible for a new nationality.
But what do you think about things like, you know, I'm not sure it's still the case, but it used to be in Germany that there was if you were children of a Turkish, doesn't he have to choose initially?
Yeah. And that's true here. So let's say my brother was born to a English father and a American mother, and when he was born, they had to choose which passport he wanted.
But that's because of the American law, isn't it? Not ours. We can have multiple passports.
That's right. Although I think you still have to. I'm not sure that you immediately get two at once. I think you often still have to choose one or the other.
It used to be the case. It wasn't about choice, it was called the jus sanguinis, the law of the blood.
Mm-hmm.
So in Germany you couldn't choose your nationality, you had the nationality of your parents, even if you were born in Germany.
In the place, uh-huh.
Yeah. So that's changed as well.
It's interesting. It's interesting. I mean, I think in a way exactly where international law comes in is where people are having to recognise the complexity of the situation. How do you deal with immigration? How do you deal with marriage? How do you deal with children who are bilingual and born of multiple different cultures, which is really, really common now? You know, and some of these issues need to be brought into the sort of the debate a little bit more strongly, but never to lose sight of what you said, which is absolutely right, that if I now go to, you know, if I go back to Tamil Nadu, I'm going to be there as an outsider, and there will be insiders, and I'll be dealing with the situation of trying to negotiate that gap. But I just think that the idea that it's a big wall with a single gate, which you may never be able to open, is also problematic. We'll come back to some of this, but let me just look a bit further, briefly through the kind of issues that I wanted to raise in respect of this kind of study of religion's discipline. How should it be done? We asked last week, why should you study religion? Different answers kind of half came up. I thought, you know, one of the reasons would be that people hope to... I think it used to be the case that people were trying to study humanity, human culture and human nature, the essence, common human life, and then the diversity of the ways that can be expressed and developed culturally. And as a part of a general project of amassing knowledge of human life and culture, that's one of the reasons why people do this, especially where it's study of more than one religion. Otherwise you go to the Oriental Studies faculty and engage with one religion. And that you can do, of course, and that there's a certain eros, I always think, within the Oriental Studies faculty. Do you need a...
Yeah, sorry.
There you go. Oops, sorry. I always feel there's a certain eros within the Oriental Studies faculty of people who've decided that they've fallen in love with a certain culture and they've committed to it and they've made it their life, which is wonderful in itself, and often we end up doing that. But there's also something slightly different going on when you've decided that you want to survey a wider range of situations. And that's interesting in itself. It's an important part of understanding other communities, so having a particular access to a particular community, of course, as well. Part of a hermeneutic of ourselves and our own culture, often leading to a revisionist understanding. There's a long history, I think, of doing study of other cultures so that you can come back to your own culture and say, therefore we have a new mirror which helps us to revise our situation, kind of a self-critique and self-improvement process. And also it's studied as an intellectual and aesthetic pleasure. I think that's a part of it that sometimes it could be made explicit a bit more. You know, A-level students come and they hear about some bit of Buddhist culture and there's kind of a upwelling of enthusiasm and excitement and, you know, awe and interest, which is of a kind of an aesthetic character, but it's never acknowledged, and it's almost as if they're not supposed to acknowledge that too much. They need to push it back down and be scientific. Of course, sometimes it's applied. It's part of creating an effective society. More and more, you know, one expects that religious studies gets promoted as, you know, trendy, modern, you know, Brownite or Cameronite governments talk about multiculturalism and so on and so forth. It is practically beneficial, and this came up last week, for visiting and interacting with other cultures. It is kind of nice, actually, when you go to another place, you've got some, even if it's imperfect and incomplete, some hook in your mind for understanding what's going on. I think it's helpful for me when I've been in Islamic cultures, it's helpful for me when I've been in all sorts of cultures, just to have some sense of what the meaning of things that are happening around you. And does it actively overcome prejudices? I think potentially. Gives you some kind of bridge by which to understand. Applied, I've put that it is a spiritual resource, and again, that's another thing that isn't always acknowledged. A lot of people I know, a lot of sixth formers who come up to do the subject, do it because, especially religious studies is seen as terribly secularist. A lot of students come to the subject because they're actually looking for some kind of interesting ideas. Dennis Turner once said, you mustn't treat, the problem with religious studies is that it treats religions like a supermarket, where you can go and take bits off the shelves and then, you know, cook them into a big cake that you quite like the look of. And that may or may not be problematic, but I think it's in many respects one of the things that's happening, actually, in religious studies faculties. People are actually exploring options. And it's also a creative process in terms of creating religion or religions. We'll talk about that a bit later. And of course, for the insiders, it's a theological practice of deepening their own faith. How should it be studied is a big issue that arises. Is it this idea of many disciplines, many tools working on the same object, you know, many lights being cast on the same complex sculpture, as it were? We have this idea that it should be studied as a non-centered, non-generalizing process, kind of pluralistic describing and listing, so that more and more people try and look at it as if you're not standing in any particular place or any particular subject or any particular confessional background, but you're able to move fluidly without, you know, sort of stopping and standing and rooting yourself in any particular place, which I think is an interesting idea in itself. Again, quite attractive, although it may be difficult and not well articulated. The human sciences and the university have tended to see you as a technical specialist in some particular skill and perspective on your subject, which gives you a way in. And we, in a sense, are saying, no, we're not going to stop in any one place. We're going to keep our balance. We're going to keep moving.
But that's kind of refusing to take responsibility.
But is it? I mean, this is the question. Can you, in fact, use different methods and see your subject in different ways and have different goals for your study all at once?
I'm sure you can, but the thing is, if you don't know where you're coming from and what your arguments are, then, I mean, even that perspective has...
But is it a matter...
perspective has a few arguments from where it's coming from, you know.
Yeah.
The thing is, you can't be... If you switch around so much, you can't be an Orientalist and an anti-Orientalist after, you know what I mean?
I know what you mean, and
You'd contradict yourself.
Yeah, I have to hurry, I'm sorry. I think that's right, but I also think it's wrong. I mean, or at least I think this is exactly what we're trying to ask. And last time we almost ended up saying, well, you know, why do you have to be in one place or another? We use different tools. We go, you know, you do a psychological study of Tantra, and then you do a sociological study of Tantra, and then you do an anthropological, and then a theological, and then a linguistic, and then you put them all together and you've got a really good picture. the question is whether that's good practice, and you can add up perspectives and methods, or whether there is methodologically a problem. I don't think it's the same thing as saying, I don't know where I'm coming from. It says, I know exactly where I'm coming from. It's these seven different places, if you see what I mean. So you can articulate where you're coming from. It's just that you're saying, yeah, lots of different angles all at once.
I'm just saying that you can, of course, you can apply different methods, but still you'd have to kind of have a point that you argue from.
But do you? I mean, if you're saying anthropologically this is what people do, and I've shown this side of religion, and psychologically here's their meanings, and I've shown this side of religion. My goal is to get as full an understanding of what happens in people's religious lives as possible, and I've now used these methods to try and achieve this goal in respect of this object of study. You may be right, but we would need to articulate what's wrong with that.
What's method and what's...
Yeah.
Well,
if you're an insider, you probably need to have a position that you're arguing from. If you're an outsider,
I think, let me leave it up for grabs. I think it's a question, and some people will say, where are you coming from? But what does it even mean to say, where are you coming from? If someone's just saying, I want to illuminate this object, and I'm going to use this light, x-ray, and blah, 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 and all kinds of different things.
I think I'd make a difference between method that you apply and a
what
kind of worldview and what you believe in and why you're doing this.
Somebody asked you, would you use tantric yoga yourself to achieve whatever it is tantric yoga claims to do?
Yeah.
Then that would be putting you on the spot.
Well, of course, but I've already said my object is not to achieve the goals of tantric yoga. My object is to understand tantric
yoga. Well, in that case, you're an outsider.
If that's true, then my point would be that it's not that we can't use lots of different methods without without being okay. That's not the issue. The issue then is simply insider-outsider, theology versus religious studies. That's the only difference in perspective, where it actually involves two different worldviews. Whereas between the anthropologists and the psychologists and the archaeologists and the linguists, it's not a problem. So it's only that kind of issue. So hopefully, you can try and come back at that through the phenomenology of religion. I think in that respect, there is a real problem. I think, or at least... There's more clearly some kind of question that has to be answered. I think that's quite right. So in any case, I think it does raise the question, how much of that flexible location can you keep, and at what point do you have to answer a deeper question? We talked about, Jonathan Smith wrote an essay, Religion, Religions, Religious. Are we studying Christianity, Christianities, Christians, Christianness? What kind of things are going on here? Some people will say, we'll ask the question, are we describing groups of people or are we describing ideologies? This comes up in anthropology a lot. Ethnography will say, let's take a group of people and try and figure out what's happening with them. Sociology may say, well, hold on, I want to look at the ideas. That's the entity I want to look at, is Christianity, the idea, rather than a bunch of people who call themselves Christians. So there are actually different questions there. Is it the ideas you want or the people? And they won't always necessarily be the same. Of course, the interaction between those two might be the really exciting part. Should truth commitments be allowed? Can they be avoided? This is the issue that we kind of touched upon. And indeed, kind of what we said as well, that the idea that in studying even a single subject, a single religion, we may be studying multiple religions in and of themselves. Should we be studying them as parallel strands or interweaving entities? And I think that isn't done as much as people would like, quote unquote. That, say in the Hindu Studies Center, there's been an intention to invite the person in the Islamic Studies Center who studies Indian Islamic history, because there ought to be a deeper sense of how the religions have engaged and mutually created each other. But of course, that doesn't happen quite as often in many respects as it should, partly because the discipline makes those separations in the way it structures its papers, its courses, its lectures, etc. And that's not ideal for us, the students. Now, the next bit I'm going to ignore for now because actually that's what we're going to study, we're going to look at next week, the question of how could you have a study of religion discipline that is not Western-centered? Could someone construct, what would it be to have a study of religion that comes from all the religions, that comes from within, and not just from within theology? You know, this is so much of the critique that's leveled at the study of religion, is that it's Western theology rooted, originated, and still reflects that in various ways. You know, so what are the resources we have for actually coming up with a study of religion that comes from the other religions as well? One of the things we'll look at next week is what kind of precedent exists elsewhere for doing that kind of thing. One of the things that's interesting, I think, is that often in other cultures we can't find objective scientific scholars studying a multiplicity of religions in a quote-unquote objective scientific way, because objective scientific methodology is terribly Western. However, if you can look outside of it, you may well find people from different backgrounds studying a range of different worldviews comparatively. It's just that they won't necessarily claim to be outside of all of them. You know, you look at Herodotus. What it looks like in other cultures is something more like interfaith dialogue or comparative theology, people from within talking to people in other cultures, partly because you didn't tend to have people who claim to stand outside. Which actually fits in very well in many respects to what has been said more recently, this idea that phenomenology has to become hermeneutics. People have to recognize that they themselves have a position that they bring to the table. Even if they claim to be objective scholars, they too are in a particular context, from a particular place, with a particular agenda. And when they talk across the table to people within the religions, they're not talking down at a set of categories, they're talking across the water, as it were, to other people who are on the same level, who everyone has a perspective that they bring to it. Okay, I mean, Said's critique in Orientalism, which is, I've always find it hard to read because it's focused so much on Middle Eastern, on sort of Arabic cultural issues. It doesn't necessarily engage immediately with other cultures. Richard King wrote a book which tried to extend this to the study of India. And perhaps it could be done fruitfully to take Said's kind of post-colonial Arab-oriented critique and extend it to a much wider range. How would that look in respect of East Asia? How would it look in respect of Africa? Are they the same issues that arise? It's not necessarily the case that it is. We've looked at the idea that Talal Asad, for instance, has suggested that we complexify our understanding of other cultures. Asad particularly suggests that we do an anthropology, having anthropologized all the other cultures, we do an anthropology of secularism itself. Do that ethnography. Do that study. Look at what it means to come inside and step outside again of the secular worldview, which of course is an interesting case because that's what a lot of people are doing. I was in Holborn yesterday, and you're surrounded by immigrants from other countries where they were within a religious worldview. Now they've stepped into Holborn with all its kind of neoclassical secular buildings in a world which is supposed to be in some sense secular. And you're selling the London Metro, which represents some kind of confused Gordon Brown-esque multicultural perspective. And it would be interesting to have an anthropology of what that looks like, what for the people who are doing that. You know, we are the insiders, and they, as it were, can be the outsiders coming into that perspective. There's been a big move to try and talk about re-embedded religion. Religion as not just an isolated territory or realm of ideas. Religion is embedded in people's lives and a broader range of experience, and not so much a kind of an alienated discipline. Talal Asad has said that the idea, it's an interesting idea because I think methodologically people have said, you know, you don't suddenly do something religious and then stop doing something religious in most cultures. Religion is a much more pervasive entity which spreads throughout your life. People often describe their religion as a way of life rather than a doctrine or a creed located in a sacred space in a church I love Monsieur Eliade's The Sacred and the Profane, but of course it's very problematic in many respects because it seems to cut off the religious sphere and take it out of your everyday life. So there's been a move to kind of put it back into everyday life, which is very valuable. Charles Taylor has argued for this, re-socializing religion, and claiming that that will help return its meaningfulness to us in the Western context. Not something that happens in church once a week, but something that happens all the time in everything you do. Although Talal Asad, again, has kind of critiqued this and says it reflects the West's desire to kind of divest religion of its unique power by putting it back into a kind of public, secular, everyday world. I think I feel a bit sympathetic with both. Yes, it should be part of everyday life. I think D.Z. Phillips writes quite interestingly about the way that religion is part of a broader perspective, a part of your general picturing of the world and your agency within it. At the same time, if you say, a lot of people have ended up saying it's just everyday life, that your everyday life is basically your religious experience, and have denied the validity of talking about religion as something distinctive in itself. You know, for a long time, religion was seen as utterly unique and special, kind of Rudolf Otto-esque. And actually, people have gone the opposite direction from that. Useful corrective, but at the same time, there's a danger that you lose religion. Often the people who are writing that are exactly the people who've never had a Rudolf Otto-esque religious experience, who don't feel that they have a religious life, and who want to try and reintegrate people who consider themselves to be secular into our idea of the religious. So, for instance, I feel bad now because I can't remember who it is. It's one of the people writing in the Critical Terms in Religious Studies book. Talks about the idea that we need to extend the notion of religious experience to encompass a much broader range, which will be not only Christian prayer, but even capitalism, civil society rituals. I think that's valuable, useful, and right. But at the same time, this person is writing from a perspective where there's kind of an expression of the idea that they don't think there's anything that's special about religion. And you get the sense perhaps they've never... more and more I teach classes where you teach Rudolf Otto and he talks about this incredible, unique feeling, and you'll say, does anyone know what he's talking about? And they'll all say, no, I have no idea. I don't think such a thing exists. And then there'll be like two people at the back who say, no, actually, it does exist. I've experienced it. And they're looked at as kind of freaks, confusing, strange people, you know. Which is not, you know, it's not judgment in either direction, but it's a problem of understanding, I think. You know, and you don't want to make it that if the majority say there's no such experience, and then put it into the books so that effectively religion no longer looks at such experiences, and that has been negated, that can't be altogether healthy, I think. At the same time, you know, that there's something terribly important in this idea. Peggy Morgan, that debate I talked about in Oxford about the future of religious studies, Peggy Morgan suggested there shouldn't just be an Oxford Centre for Jewish Studies, Hindu Studies, Islamic Studies, Buddhist Studies, but also, in a sense, theology should become the Oxford Centre for Christian Studies. And we can have a Centre for Sikh Studies, Jain Studies, Confucian Studies. And she said, and perhaps then we should also have a Centre for the Study of humanism, a centre for the study of political ideologies, as a, you know, and then you can ask the question, what would the faculty become? It would no longer be, would it still be religious studies? Would they all become religions? Would it become the Department of Worldview Studies? You know, it'd be kind of interesting, I think, to reflect upon it. In some ways, I think this is quite right, that there are things which are, in a deep sense, things which share the structure of a religion, that maybe need to be brought in to the remit of the faculty, but it would be very interesting to reflect upon what the faculty would become at that stage, and again, where truth commitments would lie. In that
respect... Isn't there a problem, as
can I
in all of that, in some sort of distinction between religious-type behaviour, which you can see in a Marxist regime, and religion?
Sure, but that's something that's come up again and again.
Isn't that the kind of blurry thing that people like Ninian Smart have brought into it to say, well, okay, you can look at Marxism, you can look at capitalism as a religion.
I have to be a bit rude because we literally
have
a very short amount of time. But in that respect, yeah, absolutely. And when Ninian Smart says, having introduced the seven categories, well, I mean, I don't, I mean, I think in a sense you can't say you're wrong or you're right. You can say, this is how I'm going
to
do it.
Maybe we're trying to be too...
Yeah, no, the thing I love most is that people are wrong.
Okay, let me rephrase that. You can say they're wrong, but all I mean is that you can't ever really... Can you legislate to get them out? You know, if you're in the faculty and you say they're wrong, and your friend Lisa's in the faculty and she says they're right, which of you is going to win? Is it going to be the one of you who gets a higher mark and becomes a professor and then gets to determine the rules by which the faculty proceeds?
You just have to know.
Yeah, sure, but then that's fine. That's fine. But that's what I mean, that you can't. We can all express what we think, but if you're going to end up making one view the dogma, as it were, the approach, and taking the other views and making them inadmissible, that would be a problem.
You mean so I can't legitimately go outside and go, you know, the God delusion, he doesn't know what he's talking about?
Legitimately, yeah, because that's what you've said, that's what I think. But what
but
I mean
really,
is that...
If you look at the evidence, he doesn't know what he's talking about, surely.
I'm not going to get into it too much. This is debate. This is what we do in faculties. But typically, what you don't do in faculties is decide that you don't like what the other person says and then move to get them taken out of the faculty. If you see what I mean. I mean, that's the point at which you then lose debate. You know, so what you have is, I agree, I think this is a really important question. Maybe then you would want to write the book that says, I'm going to go against Ninian, I'm going to say that's not helpful, and I want to make a stronger divide and argue for it well and intelligently. But in the meantime, that's still the debate. That's one of the things that's circling within the subject, you know. And if you make the argument and people go along with it, then in fact the other view will slowly slide away. But you will have created a new subject. It's not so much that you're saying that is what religious studies is. It isn't that other thing. You're saying that's what religious studies should be. Do you agree with me? Are you going to come along and be in this new subject which I'm going to create, which has clearer boundaries, if you see what I mean? It's a creative thing. That was my next point, fortunately, that Jonathan Z. Smith says that what we do is creative. We're creating the discipline. We're creating, and we've said this before, people say it again and again, but it's important to be clear how it's true. We're creating the realities of religion. And John Hinnells, quite interestingly, in his introduction to, I think it's the Routledge Guide to Companion to the Study of Religion, says, he tells the story of how he wrote for ages about the Zoroastrian community. And one day he realized that Zoroastrian community itself was using his textbooks to teach religion to their young, to young children, and that what he had written about Zoroastrianism was becoming Zoroastrianism. You know, and of course he'd go back to do a new edition of his book and realize he'd gotten something wrong, but actually what he'd gotten wrong had become right, because people were taking it as the measure of what their religion was. You know, and he suddenly it comes to him how much responsibility there really is in what he's doing. Quite a powerful thing. Okay. Well, on the next page of that handout, I asked a range of questions that I won't go into now, though some of them I'd love to get, have gotten an answer to, I think. You know, there was a movement at one point, partly under the guidance of people like Ninian Smart, that everyone should go and do a bit of anthropological work, even within religious studies. Even if that just meant going to Southall and doing a study of diaspora communities, having to live there, and try and get some actual practical experience of what it's like on the ground. I think it'd be interesting. You know, more and more there's a move that Oriental studies, linguistics, should become part of every religious studies student's training. And that's happening. Should there also be, you know, half a term of anthropological research somewhere? It's hard to make it work, but it's not the point. Should it actually be there? I'm going to move on, just really briefly, to the phenomenology of religion. And notice that it's dealing with a lot of the same issues. How can we deal with insider-outsider discourse? How can we deal with truth claims? This issue that comes up again and again. Phenomenology of religion is, of course, complicated because when we say it, we mean a range of different things. It used to confuse me greatly. Partly we mean what Gerardus van der Loo, Ninian Smart, Cantwell Smith, and a lot of other people, even Evans Pritchard, meant when they talked about phenomenology of religion. They just meant describing it without judging it. I mean, essentially, that's what they meant. And they did mean trying to be responsible about using terms from within the religious context. But ultimately, it's like Evans Pritchard says, you know, this, the method which is the phenomenological one is just a comparative study of beliefs and rites to determine their meaning and social significance. And the anthropologist is not concerned with the truth or falsity of religious thought. That kind of point comes up again and again. Douglas Allen, who wrote about it in the Routledge Companion, again, he says, the phenomenology of religion attempts to suspend value judgments about what is real or unreal in experiences of others. It attempts to describe, understand, and do justice to the religious phenomena as they appear in the religious experience of others. In some respects, very straightforward, and it has become what we do. You know, if you express a value judgment about something, you do it at the end as a kind of an additional point that you have to make. You don't do it all the way through and say, well, you know, tantric people, they do all kinds of funny things, I don't really like it, you know, they get involved in dark, nasty, dirty and uncomfortable, you know, ethical practices. That would be inappropriate and bad scholarship in many respects. You can't judge, the implication being you can't judge something until you understand it. And after you understand it, having done that job, you may then want to add this other dimension onto it. It's kind of an interesting point. I've put here a number of different people who kind of argue for that position. Just an interesting issue that arises, though. Ninian Smart, who's very influential in making phenomenology of religion the norm, who called religious studies, amongst other things, polymethodological doodling, which sounds quite right, also said to his students that if they did his course, they would be doing time travel. And eventually he said when he was on airplanes and people asked what he did, rather than religious studies, he'd say he did worldview analysis. You can kind of see the influence of that in Peggy's idea. But it also raises this question, nice quote from Smart, whether or not such an invisible world exists, it forms an aspect of the world seen from the point of view of those who participate in religion. It is believed in. But, he says, and this is an important point, so a separate quote, this is an important point, but religion is not something that one can see. Crucial point. Religion is not something that one can see. It is true that there are temple ceremonies, religious art. These can be seen, but their significance needs to be approached through the inner life of those who use these externals. It is not enough for us to survey the course which the religious history of humankind has taken. We must also penetrate into the hearts and minds of those who have been involved in that history. He really raises the deepest question that we've had to deal with in the phenomenology of religion, as it's taken this turn over into hermeneutics, which is how can you get, if you're trying to talk about the meanings of the things, if you're not just talking about the acts, but what Edmund Husserl called the eidetic structures, the essences, the meanings of the things. How on earth are you going to do it? That other insider-outsider debate, how are you going to go from the outside to the inside of people's heads? In that respect, phenomenology has moved on to not just try and, you know, give an insider's account of something, but to get deeper than the insider's own explicit self-understanding. To understand the insider better than they understand themselves, as it were. And that's where the philosophical side of religion has come in, of the phenomenology of religion. The idea that in order to understand them, you're really going to have to try and understand what their subjectivity looks like. Incredibly difficult, fantastically speculative, may never be able to be verified or validated, because the hard part is you can't say, I think this is how your subjective world works, Mr. Navajo. Would you like to take a look and confirm this for me? The whole point is that often the subjective structures of our understanding are not transparent to us. We're not aware of how our minds work. And this is a subject that tries to get deep in and reveal them. Even people who try and study their own, the subjective structures of people's basic understanding within their own traditions, people like Max Scheler, who tried to bring in an understanding of the emotions and their place in religious belief, I think is much too little studied. Paul Ricoeur, who tries to look at identity, sense of self and sense of other, and how that affects Christian and also Jewish tradition. Emmanuel Levinas, who looks at how belief in God completely goes through and changes and affects your whole approach to the world. all of these people have tried to do that study and have shown that even within their own worldview, people don't really know what's going on, how they're seeing the world. How much harder is it going to be to do it for other cultures? You know, and it would be interesting if you can offer this analysis to the other culture and say, do you recognize this? Does this sound right? It would be like taking Gavin Flood's book on the tantric body, in which he tries to look at the basic subjective structuring of awareness and identity from the perspective of a tantric practitioner. He talks a lot about the relationship between self and body, how you make your tradition part of your self-identity, and indeed for them part of their bodily identity, that they interact quite strongly. Fascinating, very important, of course, and it's one of the deepest kinds of study of another worldview. It's always going to be a difficult thing. Doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. I think we should do it. But it's always going to be difficult because it's quite hard to take it back to the person and say, do you recognize this? If they say no, doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong. You know, I think a lot of Jews wouldn't necessarily recognize Emmanuel Levinas's account of their own belief. Doesn't mean, again, that he's wrong or not. It becomes philosophy, in a way. Philosophy doesn't necessarily, continental philosophy, doesn't necessarily have to verify what it says. It offers suggestions that may be illuminating. And it lives with that fact, I think. Well, I've kind of left it at this. I just want to say at the last that one of the things that's happened with phenomenology, both the philosophical side of it and the kind of, you know, general methodology of studying religions side of it, is that it has kind of had to be tempered by hermeneutics, partly because it made too big a claim. This notion of the phenomenological eposhe, the bracketing of your own prejudices so that you can clearly see the other person, is so obviously problematic, given that postcolonial theory says explicitly, no, you'll always have certain prejudices, that very quickly people have said, okay, never mind, we can never completely bracket. The eposhe is not quite going to happen. And then you get a hermeneutic account that says, so then how do I acknowledge my own perspective whilst doing really genuinely good, rigorous and accurate conscientious study? And I think we see that there's both. People like Gadamer have said that all knowledge is not a subject seeing an object and then putting a representation of it onto paper. Gadamer says all knowledge is a fusion, a creation of a new object. And that object has a special character, has the character of understanding, it's illuminating. To understand is not to create a picture of something that's just knowledge, it's to create a picture of something that is a new, an interesting thing. It's a creation of a new kind of wisdom, a new kind of reality. So if we acknowledge that, the creative part of the study, if we acknowledge the intersubjective part of the study, it's both the person who's being studied and the studier. If we acknowledge that it's a different kind of goal and a different kind of thing we're creating when we study, how can we do all of that and go, hooray, then we're all creative, intersubjective practitioners, but still make sure that we're just as rigorous and strict as we've always been? In some ways, I think that hasn't been well expressed. And a lot of people are still suspicious of hermeneutics because they are scared that it will lead to a less conscientious approach. So we're still waiting for someone to do that. I think I tried to do it in some book, but I'm not sure that I succeeded. I feel a bit like Robert Neville. I think it's really rigorous, and I go back and I look at it and I think, oh man, I'm just as wishy-washy as the rest. Tragically. Anyway, but we'll get there. We haven't got time to do them. Let me hand these out. And if you get a chance next time you're in, please, there you go, fill these lecture questionnaires out. I forgot to give them out last week. We get slapped on.
Who's the guy you talk about and the stuff
of secularism? Talal Assad is one person, yeah, but it's in the notes of a different class. It's a person who writes on religious experience,
yeah.
In, I think it's either the Critical Terms of Religious Studies or the, what's the other great, the other companion? I think it's in the Critical Terms of Religious Studies. Religious Experience. And a lot of people in that book, because they all kind of share Jonathan Smith's approach, they all kind of see religious studies as something that should focus less on religion as a special category, and become a much broader, more embedded. They almost want to deny the existence of religious studies so they can reshape it, which is useful. They do a lot of hermeneutic revising. Take care, sorry guys. Bye-bye. I think it's useful, but they go too far sometimes. So the person who writes about, I cited him in a previous lecture, set of lecture notes. He's the one who ends up saying that, was it yoga practitioners or something like this, people who meditate aren't trying to do something about their inner life. They're not focusing on their inner experience. All they're really trying to do is something to do with social identity, embedded practice, awareness of sort of hierarchical relations, cultural flags of belonging. You know, and he analyzes it in this kind of way. You know, embedded in the social, physical, cultural world. But he ends up kind of denying that people who do meditation are actively focusing their thoughts inward to try and deal with some kind of inner experience of an emotional or religious or spiritual or affective nature. And you kind of think, yes, those other bits are also valid, but there is something here that these people are trying to do, which is to gain a particular experience, which in some sense is crucially religious.
So where does he say that about secularism?
Have to find the reference for you, but I think
that'd be so good, because I was thinking I might do some field work in that direction.
Interesting.
That'd be really cool.
That's interesting. I'll find out, because it's in one. If you look at the last notes, but I'll try and find that. I think I'm writing about this anyway.
Yeah.
So, if you want the reference, can I possibly get you to email me? Because otherwise, I don't have your email. I don't think.
Is it just Jessica Fraser?
It's Jessica Fraser theology.ox.ac. Super. And then, so I think I've got a couple of references on that kind of thing, actually. Kind of super secularizing the whole thing. Super secularizing, it's my new phrase.
Super secularizing.
One of the problems I have with people like Evans Pritchard, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now he knows there's no such thing as witchcraft. End of story. So he imposes his structure on this. What they're doing is just a kind of societal safety valve, is it?
But there's a nice.
He says there's no such thing as witchcraft.
But there's a nice quote from him where he says, and because I'm using this, I'm really interested, and I'm writing about all these anthropologists who go over and say, while I was there, I believed it.
Well, that's the point, isn't it?
And Evans Pritchard. It's very funny because he kind of bounces back and forth over that line. There is a quote where he says, you know, in my normal life I would never believe these things, but amongst the Azandi, I entered into their worldview. I imaginatively, you know, felt their perspective on life. In a sense, I think that he actually says explicitly, in a sense, I believed in it.
Yes.
But when I came back home, of course, I didn't believe
it.
He
was rubbish,
And
that's a kind of.
Is that
it's a very weird position to be in.
Is it hypocritical? Is it true, do you think?
I think it's true.
Yeah.
I think they are making, like, we're trying to say this is what the world is like, and we are trying to make it as inclusive as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But in a sense, some of these old anthropologists, they were more advanced in saying, hey, we can't understand the whole world. Implicitly they said, well, this is actually another world. Like, there is a geography, or like there's something that we as Westerners can't access. Whereas right now, in universities, we're trying, you know, instead of saying, look, we are limited and we are, you know, we are getting money from the government to do certain stuff, we are trying to be so open-minded that we end up just bouncing. From our own limits.
There's a kind of a crisis that happens when people go, oh, I know, oh my God, I don't know, oh my God.
And like what you said, Eastern Orthodoxy, that's like, you know, quite often it's like, oh, we haven't talked about that. Yeah.
Oh, well, never mind.
Yeah, never mind.
Peggy's
actually
quite good on that. She flags that up after, and she said, you know, people go,
You remind me, you quoted something the other week where there was an anthropologist went in to do something very similar to that.
Yeah.
And he wanted to interview the witch doctor or something.
Stoller.
Joseph Stoller.
S-T-O-L-L-E-R. He gets quoted a lot by people. In a way, you realise that if you say something kind of wild and outrageous, I saw it happen, oh my God, then you get quoted.
Yeah.
But he writes well about it. And another person who had something similar is Victor Turner is a famous anthropologist, but his wife, Edith Turner, did the same stuff. And she went back to the same community, became a participant, i.e. trained as a witch doctor, took the drugs, became part of the ceremonies, and she writes explicitly about an experience where she goes to a healing ceremony, she can feel the feeling, she's really involved, you know, and she's taken everything that everyone's taken, and she and the other witch doctors, only them and not the other people, only them, all see, she says, and she puts in italics, I saw a large entity come out of this man's back at the moment at which they called it out. And I saw it exit his back and then be taken by the witch doctor and, you know, out of the air and put into his bag. I saw it, she said, and so did they. What does that mean? And of course she doesn't answer the question, you know, but she puts it out there. Yeah. Very interesting issues.